So I'm going to be talking to you about the ecological ethics of Genesis 1 and 2, which is a good time to talk about that, seeing as we're now entered the season of creation and entering spring, and a time to reflect on what the Bible has to say about the natural world and our place in it. But it's an important subject for another reason, and that's because in some sectors, Christianity has a pretty bad rap in relation to its environmental ethics and how Christianity has related to the environment, and for some good reason too. So I'm going to look into that a bit, and particularly what's also had a bad rap is what our scriptures say about nature. So we're going to spend our time looking at that. If you hadn't caught the news, we're in the midst of a multidimensional planetary ecological crisis. This is a picture from the 2020 horrible set of bushfires we had in 2020 season in Australia. And this is a photo from Pakistan just a couple of days ago and the terrible floods that they've had there. Of course, fires and flooding we've had forever and an age. But what we're seeing and what was always predicted is that under climate change conditions, we would see more of them and more intense natural disasters of this kind. I'm not going to say too much more about that, other than to just note that we're in the midst of what is being called anthropogenic climate change. Horrible term. It just means that climate change has its genesis from the anthros, which is us human beings. That's a Greek root for humans. We have done this. And again, if you don't know that or believe that, I'm not going to try and convince you of that tonight. I'm just going to let that statement stand. But the evidence is pretty overwhelming that we have done this. And in fact, it's not just climate change, actually, where we have an ecological crisis. There's habitat loss and species extinction, pollution, all sorts of things going on. And they are all anthropogenic, have their genesis with humans. And that's related to another word that I'm going to be thinking about tonight. Sorry, these are horrible words to begin a talk with. Another terrible looking word, anthropocentrism. Which really is a statement that one of the reasons we've got ourselves into this mess is because humans have seen themselves or understood themselves or thought of themselves as being at the center of things, that we've imagined the world and the universe revolves around us, and that perhaps we're something other than or different from nature. And that's why we've ended up doing the sorts of things to the natural world that we have. So they're two words that are central to what's happening in our ecological crisis. We're going to think about those words in relation to what Genesis has to say about nature and our place within it. And that's for a very specific reason. In 1967, a historian called Lynn White wrote a very famous article, now considered a classic, in the journal Science. And the article was called The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis. And a couple of striking things about that. One is that in 1967, people were already talking quite clearly about the fact that we're in the midst of a ecological crisis, and things have clearly gotten a lot worse than they were 50 years ago in 1967. So that's a striking fact. But what I really want to talk about today is where Lynn White identifies the roots of our crisis. And for Lynn White, who was a churchgoer, he considered, and he writes quite strongly in his article, he sheets a large degree of the blame for our ecological crisis to Christianity, and particularly what the Judeo-Christian scriptures have to say about the human place within nature. Here's a couple of quotes from that. I just have to move that box over to the side so I can see. So here, Christianity is the most anthropocentric religion the world has seen. There's that horrible word again. It's a religion in which humans are placed at the center more than in any other, in Lynn White's view. Christianity not only established a dualism of man and nature, but also insisted that it is God's will that man exploit nature for his proper ends. And what he means by a dualism is what I was saying before, that this idea that humans think of themselves as somehow separate from or different from nature, that we're not actually part of it. And finally, he says, Christianity bears a huge burden of guilt. Our science and technology have grown out of Christian attitudes towards man's relation to nature. And in particular, Lynn White sheets up the largest amount of blame for that home to Genesis chapter 1, in which humans are granted dominion over the earth, which, as far as Lynn White understands, gives humans a license to dominate the earth. That's a very quick rundown of Lynn White's thesis in that now very famous article he wrote in 1967. That's been enormously influential, that article, on shaping people's perception of Christianity's relationship to environmental matters. I wonder if you have some of you have come across either that Lynn White's article directly, or at least that line of thinking. You've heard people reason in that way, that Christianity is to blame. So it's certainly commonly, even for people who don't necessarily know Lynn White wrote that article, it's a well-known thesis, both amongst some groups of Christians, and certainly within the environmental movement as well. There's a number of people in the environmental movement who have a very negative view of Christianity based on that. And we'd have to say, for some good reason too, there is some truth in what Lynn White has to say about how parts of Christianity at least have related to the environment. Now, Lynn White, he's making an argument about history. It's a long and complicated tale to go into the history of Christianity and ideas and culture and how that's shaped our attitudes to the environment. I'm not going to go in there. Just briefly, I want to say that I think Lynn White is basically wrong about that, but it is there's certainly some truth to it. But what I really want to focus on tonight is actually more important, is what he has to say about the creation stories of the Bible, Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis 2. And there it's particularly tragic what he's written, because he's really misunderstood them. And since then, because of his article, a lot of people has taken what Lynn White understood Genesis to be saying as the truth about what Genesis is saying. So I want to spend a bit of time going back and asking what is actually being written? What are we being told about creation and the human place within it, within these foundational Bible stories? So Genesis chapter 1, I'm not going to put the whole chapter up there. It would be great to do that. It is an amazing piece of narrative, really. It's actually in Hebrew, it's really a poetic liturgy. It's thought it was perhaps used as part of a liturgy in services of worship. And I'm no Hebrew scholar, but I gather that the Hebrew that is used is very poetic, and its rhythms and cadences are really work like a song or like poetry. So the first thing to talk about when we're thinking about Genesis as a creation story is to think about creation stories in general and what creation stories are for and what they're about. And that's important because I think, particularly because of, well, really the ridiculous debate that's been going on for ages between creationism and evolution about how the world began. We've been looking at Genesis chapter 1 as all these questions of, was it factual, was it not? And we've lost the core, the really important stuff about what these stories are meant to be telling us. So creation stories, any creation stories, are really stories that tell us about the nature of the world that we live in. And very often they're also stories about the nature of human beings and our place within the world. So if we just think about, I imagine a number of you have heard a number of creation stories from the First Nations of this continent. So nearly all of those creation stories, the ones that I have heard and I've certainly been told by Aboriginal elders, that the function of those stories is to say something about what the world is like that we actually see around us, to tell us about it, and also to tell us what our place is within it and what our role is within it. So creation stories actually form the base layer of what we call law or morality, if you like, but how we're to behave in the world and what the world is like. So in the time when the Hebrew Bible was being written, there was a bunch of creation stories around, and actually the dominant creation story at the time when the Hebrew Bible was being composed was the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation story. And here's a phrase from, I forget, this is from the Assyrian city of Nimrod, I think. And here we have a picture of the Babylonian god Marduk slaying the monster Tiamat. And this is their creation story begins with Marduk slaying Tiamat. And in some versions of the story, the older ones, Tiamat is actually Marduk's mother. So he's slaying his mother, and it's a brutal conflict. And in the end, Marduk ends up shredding Tiamat up and scattering her gore far and wide. And that is what forms the universe, actually. So the universe is formed by the gore of Marduk's mother being spread over the earth. That brings things into existence. Now, at that point, all the other gods in heaven get a bit worried because Marduk has just slain Tiamat, and they're worried that now they're going to be made enslaved to Marduk. So Marduk says, okay, that's not going to happen. What we'll do is we'll create humans, and humans will be our slaves to serve us. And then Marduk will create a representative on earth who is the Babylonian king. And therefore, humans will serve the gods by serving the Babylonian king. So you can see straight away there that this is a creation story that says something about what the world is like. In this story, it says the world is a violent, dangerous place created by power and powerful people. And that the place of humans is to be slaves to the powerful. So it's a story that sets the foundations for empire and domination, if you like. It's got a political meaning to it, which most creation stories have as well. So it's in that context of the Babylonian creation story, and it's actually thought that Genesis chapter 1 was probably finally written in the form that we have it now during the time of the exile of the of the Israelites in Babylon, when they were being held as hostages in Babylon, or maybe just a little bit after that, that we get Genesis 1 composed into the form that we have now. So they're writing this story in the face of the Enuma Elish. And in this story, Genesis chapter 1, I'm just hoping that, I'm presuming that you're reasonably familiar with it, because I'm not going to put all the text up. But the headlines of this story is that the creation is brought into being by a good God's intention, not out of violence, not out of cosmic violence, but out of love, actually. And not only is creation the product of violence, it is the product not only of intention, but it is good. And actually the poetic refrain through Genesis chapter 1, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is very good, seven times over. And seven is the Hebrew number of completion. And there's all sorts of wonderful stuff about the role of seed and fertility in Genesis chapter 1, which I'd love to go into, but that will sidetrack me from for what I want to talk about. So we have a good creation, and then the final act of creation is the creation of humanity, of many creatures already, a creation full of creatures. Humans are created as another creature. So one creature in the community of creation, the community of creatures, if you like. So that means humans are created last and into an already ordered cosmos. So one of the other features of how Genesis paints creation is that it all happens in an order and it is being ordered. So the sun and the moon create order, and the birds of the air and the fish of the sea all behave to a certain order of things. In a modern sense, we would call it all behaves to a certain ecology, if you like. And humans find their place within an already established, within an already established ecology. We might call it a moral ecology because it has moral implications. We'll come back to that in a moment. But here's where we come to the problem for Lynn White, is what is the task and what is the said about the human place within creation. So here I'm going to put up the text from Genesis 1:26. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." Now, first, just quickly, it's worth pointing out that let us make humankind in our image. The idea of humans being in the image of God was not actually unique to the Hebrew Bible. It was present in other religions, in the religions of Babylonia, Assyria, and Egypt. But actually, the image of God in all of those religions was reserved for one person, the king. So in this creation story, all humans, women and men pointedly, and this is in a very patriarchal world of the ancients, are being described as bearing the image of God. So that's a powerful statement right from the start. And perhaps really, if you think our roots, if you think our roots of democracy lie in ancient Athens, actually this is, I would say, the real roots of our ideas of democracy. But then we have the problematic statement, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, etc. And here's where Lynn White says, aha, see, humans are being given the right to dominate. And that's what we've gone and done, because the Bible said we could dominate, and then we've gone and dominated nature. And look at the mess we've got ourselves into. So we need to look a bit more closely at actually what we're being told, because not only is it, we need to think about this particular word dominion, but actually one of the problems with the way Lynn White has read this story, he's read it almost abstracted that text from everything else the Bible has to say. So if we just accept the word as we have it in English, dominion, and the Hebrew word underlying that is radar, I think it's pronounced something like that. So in most of your Bibles, it will be translated as either dominion or rule, the rule of humans. That's a word that occurs frequently throughout both Old and New Testaments. In New Testament, it's in Greek, but in the Old Testament, the word radar occurs frequently, and it's usually used in relation to kings and such like people. And the Old Testament has a lot of stories about kings, good and bad kings. It's got stories of prophets speaking to kings, denouncing kings. And in Deuteronomy, there's even instructions for kings. So there's a lot of stuff about kings and politics in the Old Testament. And there's some different ideas, and sometimes it seems like some competing ideas about kings. However, all the different things that the Old Testament has to say about the idea of dominion or rule agree on this one thing, is that dominion or rule does not mean dominate. In fact, it's the opposite of it. So the Old Testament affirms and insists again and again and again and again that whenever the rule of a king turns to domination, then the rule of that king has failed. It is no longer dominion. So domination is the end of dominion. Dominion, rather, actually, just staying with the English word, is actually much more closer to our word understood by our word service. So the purpose of a king is to serve the people and to ensure the health of the nation. And actually, biblical scholar Ellen Davis writes that throughout the Old Testament, the single most common measure of whether rule, political rule of a king has been good or not is the sustained fertility of the land itself. So there is actually a direct link in the Hebrew Bible between dominion and ecological health, actually. So dominion is happening when the land is flourishing itself. So it's the opposite of dominate. Now, when we turn to the New Testament, that message gets even stronger. So in the New Testament, the idea of dominion is located firmly and fundamentally with Christ. It is Christ who is in various ways, in many ways, who has dominion through what Christ has done on the cross and Christ's resurrection and Christ's coming again. And this is what Jesus says about the form of his dominion, which sets the whole character of the Christian understanding of rule. The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, Jesus says. They dominate. But I am among you as one who serves. So the one who comes as king in Christ is the one who serves. And that is the nature of Jesus' dominion. So just by taking that English word dominion as it is, we can see that the idea that it means dominate is entirely flawed. It doesn't mean that. However, Ellen Davis, a Hebrew scholar that I mentioned before, has thinks there's a better way we can actually translate that Hebrew word. And the way she translated it is it's something more like radar means humans are given mastery among. So instead of dominion over, she thinks it reads better in Genesis chapter 1 that they're given a mastery among. And what she means by that, the term mastery is the term that applies to if you think of a master craftsperson. So someone who's become incredibly skilled at working with the materials that they've specialized in. So if you're thinking about a woodworker, someone who just knows wood, has a feel for wood, who understands wood intuitively, and not only understands each piece of wood, its own character, and can work with that piece of wood, and not just understands the wood, but understands their own tools as well, understands the limitations of the tools and how to bring tools and material wood together to bring, to shape a creative outcome, the best outcome. That's what a mastery looks like. And that's what Ellen Davis is talking about in this idea of radar, that humans are called to be people who have a mastery within creation, someone who understand it intimately. And the only way you can understand it, as any craftsperson would know at that level, is to love it. So that still doesn't necessarily get us over the problem, though, that Lynn White has raised, that humans are still at the center. This is still anthropocentrism. So let me just, I'll come to that in a moment. I just want to say something quickly about Genesis chapter 2. So in Genesis chapter 2, we actually have a second creation story. They're two separate creation stories, but they're complementary. And in that one, we have Adam, the human, not the man, that's not the way to translate them. The human is formed out of the Adama. And in some of your Bibles, it will say formed from the dirt. It is not a good translation. The Adama is the red soil. If you imagine red volcanic soil, highly fertile soil. That's what Adam is formed out of the soil and brought to life with the breath of God. So Adam, the human being, is soil animated by the breath of God. That's who we are. So this is what it has to say about what we are, earth creatures, human beings. And then Adam is given a vocation, a calling, a job to do. In Genesis chapter 2:15, the Lord God took Adam and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. And in some of your translations, it might say to till it and keep it. And till it is an agricultural term. And that's actually a bad translation because it's not an agricultural term at all. What Adam is being given to do, a task, and when we say this is a vocation given to human beings. This is, if you like, a core statement about purpose for every human being. That's what the function of this creation story is. It's something that we're all called to, part of our DNA, if you like. This is a DNA statement. Adam is called to work, and the word abad in Hebrew is abad, and it means simply to serve. So that's a common word, occurs throughout the Old Testament, wherever it means. It means to serve, to work for someone, to work for a master, to work for a king. So Adam is placed in the garden to serve and then to keep it. The Hebrew word is actually the very rich Hebrew word shema, which means sometimes translated to keep, sometimes to observe. And it's the same word that's used in the blessing of Aaron. May the Lord bless you and keep you. And there we get the idea that when in the blessing of Aaron, that the word to keep means to sustain, to protect, to nurture, and to raise up into full potentiality. It has all those meanings. But it also has other meanings. It's the same word that's used right through the books of the law in when the Israelites are being told to keep the commandments. That means to stay within them, to observe to keep the Sabbath, or the other way it's translated, which also gets to it, is to observe the Sabbath, which means to keep to the rules, to stay within the rules. But actually, it has that second meaning of that word observe, just like in our English word, which means to look at it carefully, to watch at it, to try and understand by a careful and close attention. And the idea there is that if you're to understand, to stay within the bounds, if you like, then you have to understand where the bounds lie. And to do that, you have to watch carefully. You have to understand. So another way you can understand what the vocation of humanity is being given in Genesis chapter 2:15 is something like this. The Lord God took Adam and put him in the Garden of Eden to serve and observe it. Now, that's an interesting way of thinking about it, isn't it? So it means to serve it, to work for it, and to observe it, which means that all those things mean to look at it, watch it carefully, to understand it, but also to stay within its bounds, or we might say to observe its limits. And that's a pretty significant thing. So following Genesis, as most of you would know, is part of the five books of the law, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And those five books of the law called the Torah really form the instructions for the promised land, how the Hebrews are to live. And they're full of all sorts of commandments, and they often seem pretty obscure, funny sorts of things to us. But actually, it's a whole way of life that's being it's a portrait of a whole way of life. And one way of summing up the meaning of those laws is that the Israelites are being called to observe limits in the promised land. So there's all sorts of laws about economics, about agriculture, about treatment of animals, about treatment of workers, about how you deal with the poor and the vulnerable, aliens, all sorts of things, money and credit, debt. But all of it can be summed up by this statement, really, of observing limits to all things to ensure the hospitality of all. So it's a vision of hospitality by observing limits. And so it's a So that's for rich and poor within the community of the nation of the Israelites, including the most vulnerable, widows and the orphans, and including those who come from outside, the aliens. But also, and this is repeated again and again, to show that the promised land be a land that's hospitable even for the wild animals. There's a recognition that even the rest of nature has its claim upon how you live, and you must live somehow in relation to them. Observing limits. So that's a quick take on what's on in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2. Now I want to come to the nub of the question about anthropocentrism and what these texts have to say about the human place. So I want to suggest to you that Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2 do have a kind of anthropocentric view of the human plate of humanity, and or speak of it anthropocentrically, but in a different way from the way that Lynn White meant it, quite a different way. So I want us to think about that in a different way. The first obvious thing is to say that these were creation stories, were ancient stories told for ancient people. So of course humans are going to figure at the center of these stories, because they're about humans and their instructions for humans. So of course that they're going to occupy a center place. The second thing, which would seem obvious, but I think can get forgotten, is that actually they're not really anthropocentric. The whole point of these creation stories is not to say that humanity is at the center, but God is. And in fact, that's the refrain throughout the whole Bible. Again and again, humans are being reminded that we are not independent, but we are dependent. We're dependent upon God, and we're dependent upon each other, and we're dependent upon the whole community of creation. But at the heart of everything is God. So humans aren't at the center, and we're being told that in all sorts of different ways throughout the Bible. However, there is a way in which these stories do have a kind of anthropocentrism to them, and it's certainly not to give humans a license to dominate or say they belong at the center of the universe, but it's really just to name something which the ancients saw very clearly, and which we should see clearly even more so in our own day, which is that of all the creatures of creation, humans have a special power. Now, this is not an ideological statement. It's not a doctrinal statement. It's a statement of observation, an empirical fact that of all the creatures on this earth, there's only one that can do the sorts of things that humans do. And we're being told this today again and again and again, not by religious people, but by scientists. So here's a famous quote from the biologist Edward Wilson. "Homo sapiens has become a geophysical force, the first species in the history of the planet to attain that dubious distinction." Here's a quote from the Living Planet report. And it's talking about the fact that our current geological epoch has been renamed the Anthropocene, which is the epoch dominated by humans. "This is the first time a new geological epoch may be marked by what a single species, Homo sapiens, has consciously done to the planet, as opposed to what the planet has imposed on resident living species." So they're telling us that humans have this special power that no other creature has, and what they're begging for us is to take some responsibility for that power, if you like, to master it, to stop doing so much damage with it. Right at the heart of the Genesis chapter 1 statement of dominion is the recognition that humans have special power, and the call for therefore humans to take on and to show special responsibility. And we see that backed up again and amped up, if you like, in Genesis chapter 2 with the call to serve and observe the earth, to master the power we have for the sake of the good of all creation. Now, clearly, that is not what has happened, but that's the call that still remains. So the operation of those creation stories remain the stories of the things to which we're called as the creatures that we are. This is going to be my final slide now, so I want to finish on a more positive note there and it really to bring home an example of what I mean. And here's one of my favorite books of the last 5 to 10 years. I wonder if some of you have come across this book, Call of the Reed Warbler by Charles Massey. It's an Australian book, and it's all about regenerative agriculture. It's really like the Bible of regenerative agriculture now, I would think of it. And it's a story that's jam-packed of good news stories about Australian farmers who have had conversion experiences, and that's really what they are, to become, stop thinking of themselves as just as people seeking to make a dollar from the land and begin thinking of themselves as landscape managers, people who manage the landscape for its health. And that's the frameworks for regenerative agriculture. And they're wonderful stories and stories of healing. These just incredible stories that we've seen just of everyday farmers doing amazing things with the property and bringing ecosystems back to health where they are. I won't say any more about that, but Massey talks about to do this, farmers have learned to be ecologically sensitive managers. And he talks about five landscape functions which they've had to learn. And they're things like the solar cycle, the water cycle, the soil nutrient cycle, dynamic ecosystems. But the fifth landscape function that he names that is critical to be managed is the human mind. And it's the one Charles Massey identifies as the most important of all. The greatest of all determining factors on the healthy regeneration or else degradation of those very landscapes boils down to the way we think, what we believe, and how we model in our mind the way the world and our landscapes work. What Charles Massey is calling for us to do is become people who assume mastery within creation and to serve and observe. And I'll finish up there.